A man never meant to be king crosses paths with an enchanting waitress somewhere in the French Alps. They only spend one night together, but one night is all it takes for their lives to change forever. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers. Today, we return to the opulent world of Harlequin Presents with Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir by Annie West. Before we begin, I have a confession to make. I have committed that greatest of literary sins, judging a book by its cover. I know, but I just couldn't help it. I went into the bookstore with the sole purpose of finding something completely ridiculous, and the Presents series seems rife with opportunity. The titles are generic, yet completely off the wall. Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir is no exception. I picked it up off the shelf and then packed it into my carry-on to read on a spontaneous plane ride to South Florida. I thought I knew what I was getting into. It was a silly title with a generic cover published under the same imprint that brought us Prince Remy and his conveniently wed wife. But as I sailed through the sky, I found myself eating my words, so to speak. Had I bothered to look up the author before I read the book, I might have had different expectations. Annie West is a USA Today best-selling author from Australia, and seems to have a very down-to-earth approach to her writing. Her website has sections describing her writing process, as well as offering advice to new writers. To put it simply, I like her. And what did I think of her novel, Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir? Well, let's take a look. The cover is, like I said, generic. The Presents series seems to have had an update in the last couple of years. Unlike other Harlequin novels, where the illustration blankets the entire cover, the Presents covers have half divided between the illustration and a white background. The illustration today features a pregnant woman in a gold dress leaning on a man in a tux, who is in turn leaning on a bright blue sports car. No telling what the car is, there's no badge, and doesn't seem to match any cars I know of. And all of this is superimposed on what I'm supposing is a royal palace. So, how do we get to this idyllic image? By beginning in the French Alps. Aurelie is a waitress in a small cafe in a tourist town near the French Alps. She sees guests from all over Europe, but thanks to the winter, business has been slow. But even if the night had been busy, she would have surely noticed the man who had come in earlier that night. She was honest enough to admit to a frisson of excitement as he followed her to his table. She'd been hyper-aware of his tall frame behind her and the intoxicating scent of the outdoors and warm male spice that tantalized when he passed her to take his seat. Her awareness was grounded in intense attraction. And something more. The conviction that something was wrong. It was there in the whitened grip of his fingers around his drink. In the single-minded way he downed the first glass of wine as if he'd needed it badly. Yet now he seems to have forgotten all about the drink in his hand. It was as if a dark cloud hovered over that corner, despite the dazzling effect of those stunning eyes and the couple of brief smiles he'd given her. What would it be like if his smile reached his eyes? But while Aurelie can tell that there's something going on with Old Spice over there, she's waitress savvy enough to know that she doesn't need to do anything except bring him food, drink, and a smile. And it looks like tall, dark, and brooding over there has a white knight streak in him as well, but thankfully knows when to back down. Aurelie handles her fair share of rude male patrons and handles herself well enough that he doesn't see a need to interfere. I like him already. But it's more than just a bad day that's bothering him. Lucien is the name of our hero, and he's had a triple whammy of bad news. First, his uncle, the King of Valor, has passed from a long illness, and then his cousin, the Crown Prince, died in a freak accident of a car crash meets rock slide less than 24 hours later, which means in one fell swoop, the young royal cousin, who had made a living as an architect, was now expected to rule as king when he was never meant to take the role. It's a lot to take in, and it's all Lucien can do from going completely numb. Thankfully, there's a pretty waitress with a kind smile to lead him home. It wasn't just her dimple-cheeked grin as she swapped comments with customers in at least four different languages, or the vibrant red hair pulled back in a bouncing ponytail that gleamed like jewels in firelight. His eyes followed her quick, supple movements, a mix of grace and strength as she maneuvered through the tables carrying laden plates. Then there was her easy humor. Even when that drunken lout tried to grope her, she'd used humor underscored by steel to put the guy in his place, yet leave him smiling. And sometimes, as if to remind Lucien that he wasn't completely cut off from the rest of the world, her eyes would catch his. The effect was startling. Each time warmth began to trickle painfully through his frozen being. But despite her kindness, he is, of course, overwhelmed by his loss, so he leaves the cafe. He doesn't get too far, though, and Aurelie actually finds him standing in the snow for who knows how long. And it's clear to her that he's not all that well. Physically, he's fine, but if he keeps standing there, he won't be. Mentally, however, he seems to be a mess. And Aurelie tells herself to walk away, but something in her says that it's the right thing to do. And what does she do? Call him a cab to take him to a nearby hotel? See if he has friends in town to care for him? Come on, remember what book we're reading. She insists that he follows her to her apartment to stay the night. All right, we'll get this out of the way. Do not do this! I don't care how handsome he is, how nice he was. I don't care if you think that you're going to get your good deed in for the day. Do not, under any circumstances, invite a slightly drunk stranger who seems to be out of sorts back to your apartment without even knowing his name first. Yes, yes, I know I am supposed to suspend disbelief here, but I can't let this one go. It might be different in France or even Australia, but in America, this isn't how you start a romance. It's how you end up on the 11 o'clock news. Anyway, back at her apartment, Lucien gets cleaned up, and as they wait for his clothes to dry, they play some games of chess, get to know each other, even if only superficially. But Lucien finally opens up that he's lost his cousin. And he's a gentleman, explaining that he doesn't understand the connection that he has with Aurelie, but if he doesn't leave right now, he will keep being pulled towards her. I've wanted you from the first moment that you smiled and led me to my table. I watched you walk in front of me, your scent, the sway of your hips, the perfect curves of your backside. Even the damned swing of your ponytail beckoned me. His voice ground low, hitting a husky note that dragged through her fingers like raking velvet. Hadn't she spent the evening fascinated, wanting, trying to pretend that she didn't, telling herself it was mere charity that led her to invite him here, when from the first moment she'd been driven by another compulsion entirely? I can appreciate that Lucien relied on the physical to explain to her that he was drawn to her, instead of trying to describe the personality of a woman that he barely knows. And it's nice to see the heroine absolutely into the guy in question. Let's look back at episode 1 real quick. The heroine there was, yes, attracted to the king-to-be, but she was also scared of him, and not in a position where she felt she could safely say no. But Aurelie has all of the power here. As Lucien insists that he leaves, she has no fear, no trepidation, and a full understanding that it's just for one night. After tonight, Lucien will go back to his life and Arlie will jumpstart hers. And I think I'm going to declare a trope here, the spark of something, that inexplicable draw between a couple that they don't understand but have to act on. Nearly every couple has had it so far, and I am absolutely sure that we will see it again. And we're going to take a quick look at the stopwatch, because this is so far the fastest time a book couple has gotten right down to it. I initially expected this from these books, with sex littered everywhere all over the pages, but instead, I've had to wait. Here, however, they turn up the humidity right away in those snowy Alps. I really shouldn't be surprised, though. I mean, the title alone told us that sex would happen quickly, otherwise there'd be no baby to fuss over. And the sex is actually interesting. In a lot of these novels, I feel that there's too much euphemism and nothing is clearly defined. Yes, the names for the bits are danced around and never explicitly mentioned, but we get positions, sounds, movements here. It's more than I'm used to getting, and I'm hoping to see more mainstream erotic romance novels comfortable with, you know, sex. To visit the spark of something again, there's a passage I found of particular interest, as Lucien is getting ready to leave Aurelie's apartment. It seemed preposterous when, with Aurelie, the woman whose surname he didn't know and never would, he discovered more than solace from grief. He'd found, somehow, the part of himself that had gone missing when he heard of Justin's death. He wasn't healed. His grief was too big for that, but Aurelie had given something of herself, or perhaps they'd created something miraculous together that filled the gaping hole in his heart. At least, enough for him to face what must be faced. I like this passage for several reasons. The first being Lucien is extremely grounded in his expectations of any potential relationship with Arlie. He's not putting her on a pedestal, not exactly, but he is aware that she is a moment of his life that signifies great change. He's aware of the pressure he's under, and he's with himself enough to know that Arlie offered him just a moment of much-needed rest. Also, the line that, quote, they'd created something miraculous together, is just screaming at us, isn't it? I'd call it foreshadowing, but it's a bit heavy-handed, and we all know it's coming. A delightful play on words. So, a couple of months go by, and we meet up with Aurelie again, this time as she's trekking across the country of Valor, and the bus she'd hitched a ride on had taken a detour that stopped right in front of the royal palace. She's come here on a mission, and not even getting stared down by the palace guards are enough to convince her to leave. Finally, one perceptive bureaucrat figures out that she's got a rather serious and delicate situation, and sends away for the guy she's dragged herself across Europe to see. And we get to the twist that I did not see coming. Yes, we knew that Lucien was now the king, thanks to the book's title and the back blurb, but we weren't told that he was now obligated to be married. I say obligated, not engaged, because his cousin had been set to marry Ilsa, the princess of Altborg, before he had died. It was technically a political marriage and not a love match, and there was a lot riding on the union. So Lucien stepped in to fulfill all his brother's obligations, walking away from his private life, including doing the marriage to Ilsa. And if you're starting to worry like I was that this was about to become a catfight between Arlie and the princess, I'll put your fears to rest. Ilsa is a compassionate, empathetic individual and wants the best for the people in her life, including Arlie, but we'll get to that. For now, Lucien and Ilsa are rehearsing for the wedding when Lucien gets pulled away for an unusual guest. And he'll get the shock of his life when he sees that it's Arlie, the woman he hasn't been able to get out of his head despite all efforts. He is not thrilled, but Arlie is dealing with her own emotional roller coaster. First, she finds out that the one-night stand was actually a king, And then she learns that said king is engaged to a gorgeous princess, and now she has to tell him she's pregnant with his kid. This is not a good day. And it gets worse as they discuss options. Lucien understandably has concerns. Is the baby his? Yes. Is she keeping it? Yes. Does she have family support? No. And the worst question he could ask, how much money does Aurelie want? Now she's furious. And I might be too, but we've got to give Lucien some credit here. I mean, this is news that can send royal families and whole kingdoms into panic. Entire monarchies have been brought to ruin by a king who got busy with the wrong woman. I might be a tad dramatic, but who cares? Aurelie tries to leave, but she gets hit with some nausea, and Lucien apologizes for his phrasing. He insists that he wants the best for the baby, and to be involved as a father. Placated for the moment, Aurelie really does want to leave the palace to stay somewhere nearby for the night. But she's led to a rather opulent room instead, and the message is clear. She must be kept out of sight from the press. As Lucien starts to talk to Ilsa about the situation, this is about when I start to realize that I was getting a different story that I signed up for, but it's not a bad thing. See, with a title like Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir, I expected the same sort of plastic nonsense that I got with Bought Bride from episode 1. But these characters have motivations, goals, fears, genuine personalities. And Ilsa was the character that brought this home for me. She suggests to Lucien that since Aurelie had admitted to him that she wasn't sure she was ready to be a mother, that she and Lucien could adopt the baby, legally claim them as their heir to the throne, and bring them up in a loving family with an abundance of support. I feel like in a different novel, Ilsa would have been that catty bitch that popular media has framed as the competition, while another woman enters into the love triangle. She would have done everything in her power to make Aurelie miserable and to be an obstacle for Aurelie to triumph over. If anything, Aurelie is the one being catty, responding rather possessively when Lucien makes the suggestion to her. But I really can't fault her on that one. I'd be furious too if someone wanted to take my baby from me, despite how I was feeling about the situation. But something in Aurelie is triggered. She was in a sort of Cinderella situation growing up. Her father remarried rather quickly after her mother died, and was swept into the side in favor of her half-siblings. She's terrified of that happening to her own child. Thankfully, Lucien calms her with the story of his own past, that he was raised by his aunt and uncle alongside his cousin, and knew nothing but love. He wants to make it work. And Ilsa wants to have her say as well, seeking out Aurelie later on. She confides in her that conceiving a baby would actually be very difficult for her, and would be thrilled to adopt her child. It's a lot to think about, but Aurelie makes the choice. She's going back to France, keeping the baby and raising it on her own. Lucien would be welcome to visit and be as involved as he likes, but she won't be leaving the baby in Velour. However, the day after she makes this declaration, she's told that she can't leave the palace. What is it with these men and holding women hostage? At least Lucien doesn't want her to leave until he's had a chance to talk to her. And apparently, something is up when Lucien's assistant realizes that she hadn't heard about what's got the palace in a tizzy. But Aurelie isn't tempted to find out, and when Lucien arrives to talk to her, he plays it up like he's going to drive her to the bus station to go back to France. But we all know he's not. He takes her to his private residence, where he usually lives when the palace isn't being used for formal events, but it's still just as impressive as the royal palace, just on a smaller scale. They settle down into a sitting room where Lucien drops the ball that we all saw coming. He is no longer engaged to Ilsa. And for me, the story has done its job well enough that I feel a little sad for Ilsa. She is, by all accounts, a genuinely wonderful woman. She would have done well as Valor's queen and been a compassionate companion for Lucien, despite the circumstances of their marriage. We can also surmise that she would have excelled as a mother. I think I would have liked to have seen a story from Ilsa's point of view. Maybe not Ilsa exactly, but a heroine very much like her, and in a story that gives her her happy ending. But seeing how these romance novels loved to create entire sagas based on one area or one family, perhaps Annie West will tell us how Ilsa's story turns out in another book. And for what it's worth, Ilsa and Lucien ended their relationship mutually, and I'm sure the princess will be a dear friend to the family. But freed from one obligation allows Lucien to pick up the next one. In the same conversation that he tells Aurelie that he's no longer engaged, he asks her to marry him. I think being royal must have something to do with being able to move quickly as far as relationships are concerned. And while I can appreciate that Lucien is dead set on doing the right thing by Aurelie, I can admire how gallant that he can be. He's a little bit of an idiot. They have had exactly one, counting one, night together. Yes, the romance fairy has waved her wand and made a connection between the two, and yes, short engagements are not unheard of, especially in royal situations. But Lucien, you are a king. The person you marry can have unknown repercussions that you probably can't fathom, and you've already risked a political crisis by ending a years-long arrangement between Valor and Ilsa's kingdom. This isn't just one amazing night between two ordinary people. This has consequences, and anyone who's followed the Harry and Meghan drama could tell you that. And Aurelie is more than aware of the situation. She doesn't accept the offer of marriage, though the astute will note that she didn't decline either, and she tells him that she can't stay in the palace. She's very grounded and knows that she is very, very much out of her depth. Lucien does calm her fears again with what I'm going to call an illegally intoxicating kiss, and tells her about the night that they met, and how he saw her work and how she handled people, using this as an example of supreme diplomatic skills, which, to be fair, is an interesting take on it. He's saying that Aurelie has potential, and that they have potential as a couple, and he doesn't want to miss out on the chance. And he dangles another carrot in front of her. Aurelie had wanted to go to school for a psychology degree. If she stayed in Valor with him and the baby, he would do everything in his power to make it possible for her to achieve her goal. She still insists that she needs time to consider things, and he agrees. And he, insists, that she stay at the palace as his big air quotes here, guest. So she can't leave. Somehow, I get the feeling there's going to be a singing teapot somewhere. A couple of days later, Lucien meets back up with Aurelie after handling things back at the main palace. He's still insisting that he can protect her and the baby if they get married, and she's still sure that it's a bad idea. She also questions him on getting into one relationship so quickly after leaving Ilsa, who was surely an attractive lover, but don't worry, Lucien's got it covered. Lucien drew himself up to his full, imposing height. In the last 6 months, I've been so busy with work, first as an architect and now here as king, that I haven't been with any woman except you. He paused as if letting her absorb his words. In that time, the only woman I've imagined in my bed is you, Aurelie. No one else. Her breath hissed on a stunned breath. It seemed impossible, yet everything within her urged to believe. There's only one woman I want, Aurelie. His words throbbed with a need that matched the primal pull and drag inside her own body. And this is another theme that I see repeated in some of these books. The heroine doesn't think that she's capable of being loved. Their pasts have hurt them to the point where they can't see themselves in a loving relationship because to them, it's a preposterous notion. I'm not sure why this is, not yet, but hopefully as time goes on and I read more of these, I'll put the pieces together. For now, though, Aurelie is absolutely sure that Lucin is insane to want her as his queen. And with tensions running high, they have to get some sex in. I mean, of course. She's already pregnant. Not much else worse can happen. Wait, scratch that. Way worse can happen. Forget I said that. But this is more frantic than the first time. They can't stand to be physically apart any longer, and they just have to get to it. And I know that because our author employed the old friend, show, don't tell. Aurelie had only managed to undo a couple of his shirt buttons. Lucian was more efficient. He simply gripped the open neck of his shirt and pulled. Seconds later, he tossed the torn cotton to the floor and rose before her, kicking off his shoes and stripping his socks. He straightened and she had a perfect view of his sculpted torso. She heard the hiss of his zip, the sound of his trousers landing on the floor as she leaned in and kissed his bare chest. Nothing but urgency in those lines. Perfection. The next morning, they're snuggling together in bed, as expected, when passions get roused once more. Lucian decides to pounce on the opportunity to get Aurelie to say yes to the proposal by withholding the sex that she very much wants in that moment. I'm not going to say that it counts as coercion, but it's questionable at best. She does agree, but on the condition that they don't announce it immediately. Okay, but I'm still thinking of the political consequences. It will be very obvious very quickly that the baby was made outside of wedlock, and it won't take a math major to be able to line up the timeframes for conception. This is really my only major nitpick of the book, and probably why I think top royalty doesn't exactly work for this kind of story. Dukes are practically princes, but they don't come with the responsibility, and I think they're the safer bet for this sort of romance. An entire nation wouldn't be at stake here. Something that I do like, however, is that the book doesn't dance around morning sickness that usually accompanies the first trimester. After they have sex, Aurelie wakes back up to an empty bed and a rolling stomach. This will give Lucian the chance to swoop in and show some tenderness. He does the thing where the guy holds the woman's hair as she's slumped over the toilet, and Aurelie is doing the thing where she thinks that it's the furthest thing from sexy, and then Lucian does the thing where he gets to outshine her expectations. Her father in particular hated any form of sickness, and the responsibility for caring for the house when sickness struck had fallen to Aurelie, so she's not used to the attention that Lucian is giving her. As a result, she's throwing up some sort of psychological wall. Lucian is saying that he agreed to give Aurelie time, but there are things that need to be arranged. He wants to be married well before the baby arrives. Aurelie isn't thrilled, but she agrees to give him 3 weeks. And she convinces herself that he's only excited about the baby, not the marriage. And that marriage will be the baby's best start that they could possibly give them. There's no chance that Lucian is actually interested in her as his wife. Now, while I think this is a huge leap of logic on Aurelie's behalf, Lucian could do a better job of explaining that he's actually excited about her, about having her as his partner, not just as the mother of his child. What do we always say, romance seekers? Communication is key. He does show her, though. As she's working with tutors, getting ready to become a queen, Lucian calls her to tell her that he's arranged for piano lessons. On the night that they'd met, she'd mentioned that she'd always wanted to learn piano, but never got the chance. Somehow, Aurelie convinces herself that this is just a simple and kind gesture, and not the sort of thing a spouse would arrange for their partner. I guess we can talk about love languages another day, but I think it's a conversation worth having, and more folks should be aware of the concept, in my opinion. She's also getting a stylist. Sometimes I wish I could have a stylist. I have got zero fashion sense, and it would be rather handy. That night, she's off to a gala opening, and with the help of said stylist, she's looking pretty fine in a midnight blue silk dress. And it gives Lucian the opportunity to see her mingle with the socialites of Valorcian society. They'd arrived separately, dancing around potential media, and Lucian is delighted to see her talk with gradual ease and comfort. He knows that she'll be a fantastic queen. The trouble is convincing her of the fact. But he's happy to give her the time and space that she needs to adjust to the idea of becoming royalty. Shame about that press, though. Yes, like any good royal drama, we cannot avoid the inevitable media firestorm. As part of introducing Aurelie to his world, Lucian had taken her out to lunch with some friends. It was thought to be private, but the paparazzi are relentless parasites, and they managed to sneak a few photos. Now the entire country knows about Aurelie, her name, where she's from. It's almost as bad as it could get. But instead of freaking out or shrinking away, Aurelie asks, "What can I do?" And this further proves to Lucian that he has made an excellent choice for his queen. He tells her to rest up, don't look at the media stories, study in the afternoon like you have been, and they'll talk about a game plan when he sees her that evening. And of course, what does Aurelie do? Not that! The first thing that she does after he leaves is check up on what the cesspool tabloid media is saying about her. And the worst headline has to be, "Tragic Ilsa ousted by French floozy." Ouch. This basically backs Aurelie into a corner. If she takes the baby back to France with her, any anonymity that she hoped to have will be gone. The press would follow her no matter what. So now she really has to stay. But she would stay not just because of the baby, but because she's fully admitting to herself that she loves Lucian, had loved him from the moment that they'd met. She is ready to walk through fire to make this work. And Aurelie has guts. Way more guts than I have, for sure. Because she gets dressed and takes herself down to the old city center, press at her heels, and into a bookshop. Lucian gets word and runs himself to her as fast as he can. She's tense, he can tell, but she's holding her own as she's perusing the bookshelves, picking out books for her brothers. And we get more shots of Lucian being impressed and inspired by her resolve. It's good that they're giving us examples as to why Lucian is attracted to her and actually showing us said examples in action, unlike some other novels that I could mention. The whole situation has prompted Lucian to take Aurelie to meet his great aunt, the Grand Duchess Josephine. And I'm noticing more than a few similarities between this royal romance and Crown Prince's Bought Bride. Let's see. Commoner waitress crosses path of the man expected to take the throne in an unconventional fashion. Heroine has an awful family, a made-up kingdom, an unexpected pregnancy, press and media frenzy, and now a meeting with a very intimidating noblewoman, this one an aunt. But unlike Bought Bride, Aurelie can hold her own. She's graceful around the press and the people she interacts with. There's still some marriage difficulties, but at least Aurelie isn't staring down the barrel of a literal life and death situation. She's still able to walk away if that's what she truly wants. And about that intimidating aunt. Maddie just let the nobles drag her through the mud, or at least we weren't shown that she did anything in her own defense. Josephine sends more than a few barbs in Aurelie's direction, and Aurelie flings them right back. She is not afraid to stand up for herself, and she's shown us that she isn't going to hide behind Lucian whenever it gets rough. And instead of earning an antagonist in Josephine, Aurelie has gained an ally. I love this. I think that there's a trend in popular media for heroines to see other women as obstacles, and we've even seen it in some of our novels. If you remember Brandy from episode 2, perfect example. No, I much prefer women lifting other women up, so thank you, Josephine. A couple of weeks go by, and it's 2 days before Lucian and Aurelie are set to announce their engagement. He's just gifted her with a stunning, and I do mean stunning, opal necklace. And somehow Aurelie is still operating on the idea that He's not actually in love with her, just keeping her around and supporting her just because she's pregnant with his kid. It will look perfect with that awkward dress that you've been saving for tonight. He'd chosen it because it matched her dress? She'd hoped he'd think she was perfect, not her wardrobe. That he'd see not the image she projected, but the woman desperate for his love. He described her as perfect once, but then too he'd meant appearances. Arlie's stomach hollowed as she stifled disappointment. It's an expensive gift just to match my dress. Their gazes caught and held. Anticipation rose. Appearances are important. I know you're still not comfortable at court, but wearing this will help you look the part. Hope crumbled, and Aurelie berated herself for a fool. How could she have thought? She looked down at the gems before he could read her distress. This was window dressing to help her look as if she belonged. I know I gave Lucien some flack for failing to communicate his adoration for Aurelie, but there's a little bit of Aurelie's responsibility here too. If she wants to know, just ask him. Don't guess, don't take his words in whatever direction you think they went. Just ask. You are stressing yourself out over nothing. But I guess it wouldn't be a romance novel without the drama, now would it? So that necklace had been a gift prompted by a party. And before said party, they get down to some quick and desperate sex, which Aurelie thinks is to help convince her to the marriage, and the mental gymnastics to logic that one out are astounding. Quick content warning before we move on, there's going to be discussion about potential pregnancy loss during the last part of this story. Lucien, for what it's worth, knows that there's something up with Aurelie during the party. He knows that she's bothered by something, but he can't very well confront her on it in front of everyone. However, his woman-in-danger senses are going haywire when Aurelie excuses herself to go to the bathroom. He tries to convince himself that the food just isn't agreeing with her, but those hopes are dashed when she tells him that she needs a hospital. She's potentially experiencing a miscarriage. They rush her to an emergency room, and Lucien is racked with guilt. Was it because of the stress he put her under? Was it the sex? Had he missed something? But through all of this, the one thing we're getting is his deep worry for her. More than anything, he wants her safe. After tests and medical interventions, Aurelie hasn't miscarried yet, though she's not out of the woods. It's getting late, and she insists that Lucien leave for the night, that if she loses the baby, she tells him he won't have to go through with the marriage. Lucien wants to object to all of this, but he can see that she's stressed out with him in the room, and he goes, if only to give her space so that she can focus on being well. However, when the perspective shifts back to Aurelie, she's distressed that he did leave, that if he really loved her, he would have stayed. Aurelie, honey, darling, no! You explicitly asked him for space in a hard and desperate moment where your comfort is paramount to your health and the health of your baby. Of course he left! I am willing to give her the benefit of the doubt that she's obviously scared and emotionally drained, so logical thought is probably not happening in her mind. If anything, watching Lucien give her the space that she asked for is one of the best things he could do. The last thing he wants to do is argue and potentially make the situation worse. But no matter what the intentions, Aurelie is feeling alone and vulnerable and mentally preparing to leave Valor should their worst fears come true. The next morning, she's looking out of the hospital window, crying at, well, everything, when a nurse comes in. She's got a bag that the palace had sent along to help her freshen up, and the nurses also brought glad tidings of congratulations. Congratulations of what, we might ask? Well, it looks like her engagement got leaked to the press, so now the whole kingdom knows. This is extremely worrisome to Arlie because she doesn't think an engagement would even happen if she were to lose the baby, a fear she shares with Lucien when he arrives to see her. It turns out that he hadn't left the hospital at all, obviously. He'd slept in the waiting area, and I guess being king means the orderlies can't really shoo him out. But seeing that the state she's in, worrying about the news, he does wish that he had stayed despite her protests. And he assures her that everything will be fine. He knew exactly what he was doing when he leaked the engagement to the press. That's right, in a grand gesture to prove to Arlie that he wants her, loves her, baby or no, he told the whole world that they were engaged. I don't know how I'd feel about that if I were in Arlie's hospital bed. Probably quite unhappy. But he finally uses his words and says to her that he truly loves her. He could have said it well before this point, but then we wouldn't be here, would we? And he further reveals that he never followed through with a paternity test to make sure that the baby was actually his. Because he did love her, even as he tried to deny it to himself and trusted that she wouldn't lie to him in that way. He loves her and wants her to stay as his wife. Cheerfully and tearfully, they share a kiss, declaring their full unadulterated feelings for each other, and the story ends with an epilogue. And the epilogue gives us an actual update. It's been 10 years, and they're still happily married with not one, but 3 children. Arlie has her psychology degree and is a stunning queen, and Lucien could not be more proud. It's an absolutely perfect ending. And as I closed the book, stuck in the very back of that airplane, I found myself almost disappointed. This was actually good. Not just good, great. I went in expecting a story that would be very similar to style and execution to Crown Prince's Bride, just with the addition of a one-night stand shotgun wedding. What I got was a surprisingly sweet story with sympathetic characters, and a scenario that I could actually see playing out in real life, or at least on the Hallmark Channel. With that, let's get into Heather's final score. Starting with the cover, I'm giving it a 1 out of 5. It feels very photoshopped, and it's not hiding that, and it's really not all that engaging. I can appreciate that the fact that the blue car was mentioned in the book, but none of the elements in the cover look like they were in the same country, let alone the same picture. The palace looks fake, the drive looks fake, the clothing looks fake. I even doubt that the couple were from the same photo shoot. I mentioned that I had sinned with judging the book by its cover, so I was thrown for a loop about what I would read. The story I read deserves a much, much better cover. Drama is a 4 out of 5. Instead of getting catty, jealous fiancés and high school social tactics, I got a story with genuine stakes where there was no possible easy solution. Someone was going to get hurt, no matter what anyone could do, and it was handled in what I thought were reasonable solutions. Romance gets a 4 out of 5. Lucien and Arlie have some of the best communication that we've seen so far, but it could use some work. I didn't feel like they were being smooshed together by the author's will. We were shown why they were attracted to each other well beyond their one-night stand, and the sex as it was described felt like a genuine relationship. It gets a ding from me, though, because Lucien failed to actually communicate to Aurelie that he loves her, and because Aurelie is apparently more dense than a black hole when it comes to romantic intentions. Realism gets a 3 out of 5. I'll give some slack here, that romances between commoners and royalty happen all the time, and there have been an abundance of one-night stands with royal scandals. But I don't think a real-life Lucien would have been so generous with his trust. Yep, this random woman has showed up at the palace, and she is totes carrying her baby. Yeah. And I'm not going to let go of the fact that Arlie saw a guy behaving somewhat strangely in the snow and didn't hesitate to let him into her apartment. Nope. Nope. All the nope. World building is getting a 4 out of 5. I want to bring this category out whenever we get something unusual with our setting, and that includes pretend kingdoms. I've got a real sense of the kingdom in this story. I know the landscape. I know its languages. I know its flag colors. The author did an excellent job of weaving it into the story without shoving information down my throat. I just don't know for the life of me how to pronounce the kingdom. It is spelled V-A-L-L-O-R-T, and since it's near France, I've just omitted the T at the end. And with that, I'm going to say that I actually enjoyed Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir more than I expected. I really should know by now that any expectations that I have about any of these books should go right out the window. If you like royal romance, I would absolutely recommend this read. For my final score, Pregnant with His Majesty's Heir gets 4 Architect Kings out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or just want to say hi, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster, and our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production, and it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.